This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. Our guest this morning is Terry Tamminen. As special advisor to Governor Schwarzenegger and former head of the California EPA, Terry has been an architect of America's most progressive energy independence plans. Terry Tamminen is here today to tell us about his book, Lives Per Gallon, The True Cost of Our Oil Addiction, published in 2006 by Island Press. Welcome, Terry.
Thanks for inviting me.
What led you to write Lives Per Gallon?
Well, I've been working on this book for a number of years, and of course the last few years in state government since Governor Schwarzenegger took office in 2003, I've had precious little time to work on a book, but finished it up, and the motivation came over many years of being in the environmental movement and running an environmental foundation. And as I looked around at the landscape of what the environmental challenges are, especially going into the future, it seemed to me and to many of my colleagues that the number one problem we face is our addiction to oil. And that's because, as I document in the book, it not only is literally costing us lives per gallon, it's costing billions from our treasury, it is causing us to do great damage around the world, it's harming our politics, our national image and interests at every level. It's just, in my view, attacking the very fabric of our politics and society, as well as our wallet and our health. And I felt that anything else was really very secondary compared to this, and felt compelled to start telling the story and talking about what we can do to finally shake this addiction.
Let's focus now on the lives per gallon aspect. What are the implications for human health of using gasoline to power our vehicles?
Well, first of all, it's worth noting that what comes out of the tailpipe of most cars and trucks has a remarkable similarity to secondhand tobacco smoke. And in the book, I actually lay out a chart and some of the details on that, that benzene and all kinds of other rather nasty toxins are both found in tobacco smoke and in vehicle exhaust. And so you wouldn't be surprised then to learn that many of the harms are the same. Asthma, lung cancer, and similar respiratory diseases. But, of course, the lives per gallon goes beyond just the health implications. It has to do with our defense of oil around the globe and soldiers dying. It has to do with third world countries where oil is produced and the devastation that is caused in the wake of developing oil in those countries. So the lives per gallon, in many ways, are very hard to measure.
How do the toxic emissions from burning fossil fuel in autos compare with other sources of toxic emissions?
Well, it really runs the gamut because, first of all, we typically think about air pollution from burning fossil fuels in cars as being the main source of the way we burn petroleum and the way we create that smog, but it actually starts much sooner than that. There's a great deal of pollution that's caused from drilling for oil. Many of the oil rigs, as I describe in the book, are the major sources of sulfur dioxide in the communities where they are drilling for oil and other pollutants. It continues at refineries, where now the research shows that people who live as far as 30 miles downwind of a refinery are at elevated risk of cancer and other respiratory diseases. And of course, many of those toxins end up in drinking water, so we ingest them in other ways. It continues with the refined fuel in storage tanks and in pipelines, which frequently leak. And again, I go into some detail about that in the book. That pollution gets into our drinking water and into our food. And then, of course, finally, when it's combusted in the vehicle, there are not only toxins such as benzene and toluene and xylene and so forth, but the soot that you see coming out of, for example, buses, the diesel soot, the particulate matter, which is extremely insidious because the very finest particulate matter that comes from that combustion goes deep into the lungs and not only causes damage in and of itself, but acts as thousands and thousands of tiny sponges which absorb other toxins in the air and take them deep into our bodies.
In your book, you point out that policymakers have been slow to put forward regulations that would protect human health from the toxics generated by gasoline production and combustion, even when the adverse health effects have been clear. What are the reasons for this?
Well, I think there's two reasons. One is politics and the other is lies. And the politics is pretty easy to understand. As I lay out in the book, the oil industry has spent about $186 million in the last 15 years or so on political campaigns in Washington, and they've reaped $1,000 in tax benefits and credits and incentives and other subsidies for every $1 of campaign contribution investments. So as you can imagine, they're going to continue to make those kinds of campaign contributions for a long time to come. If you could get $1,000 for every dollar you invested, I suspect you would continue it. But the other reason is lies. And as I lay out in the book, going back to the 1920s and 30s, General Motors, Firestone Tire, Standard Oil of New Jersey, which is now ExxonMobil, and a number of other conspirators got together and created what was called the National City Lines Company, and it was a shell company for these conspirators, to go around and buy up clean electric mass transit in 45 U.S. cities and scrap the clean electric cars and rail and replace it with dirty diesel buses, which we live with the legacy of that to this day. And I use the term conspiracy advisedly because in 1947, they were found guilty in federal court of this conspiracy by the Truman administration, antitrust violations and other violations. Unfortunately, by then, the damage had been done, and in many cases, not only had the electric trains been scrapped, but the train tracks were ripped up and the streets repaved, very often with asphalt that was purchased at taxpayer expense from oil companies. And we live with that legacy, as I say, to this day. And since then, from the 1950s onward, there's been a pattern and practice of lies and deceit by the oil and auto industry on everything from high-octane fuels to lead in gasoline to catalytic converter technology to other things that could have made petroleum products cleaner and safer and cars cleaner and safer, destroying the corporate average fuel economy standards in this country, which certainly would have given us more productivity out of the fuel, and obviously we'd be burning less of it today if that had moved forward, as well as killing things like the electric car. A recent popular movie, Who Killed the Electric Car, documents that fairly well, and I talk about it in the book as well.
In your book, you draw parallels between tobacco companies and the oil and auto companies. Could you explain?
Well, that pattern and practice I mentioned of lies and deception to regulators, which makes it impossible for them to do their job, is very similar to that activity by tobacco companies, which, if you go to the 1950s, under increasing pressure from health officials and regulators, the tobacco companies issued what they called a frank statement, and they said, okay, maybe our products are harmful, but we're going to get all the companies together, we're going to check our competition at the door on this one issue, we'll form the Tobacco Institute to research what's happening with our products and make them safe when used as directed. The record showed they did the exact opposite. The Tobacco Institute was a front for them to conceal the science and lie to regulators and the public while they were killing millions of their best customers. The exact same thing happened in the mid-1950s, the same time frame, when regulators and health officials were concerned about the effects of smog. And the auto companies got together and said, okay, you know, we'll check our competition on the door on this one issue. We'll work together to make sure that what comes out the tailpipe is not harmful to human health. And they formed the Automobile Alliance, it turns out, to do the exact opposite, to lie to regulators, to conspire, to defeat things like catalytic converters and other technologies that would have cleaned up their products significantly, and then more recently to destroy cleaner alternatives such as zero-emission vehicles, battery electrics, and so on. So they've acted very, very similarly, and the results have been similar, as I mentioned before. When you look at the health harms and the reason that those health harms are occurring, it's because the same toxins are coming out of a tailpipe as are coming out of a cigarette.
I'm Diane Horn, and we are speaking with Terry Tamminen, former head of the California EPA and author of the book, Lives Per Gallon, The True Cost of Our Oil Addiction. One chapter in your book is titled Postcards from the Year 2025 that give two very different visions of an energy future. Could you describe the two different visions?
Well, absolutely. If we continue on the path we're on with our dependence on fossil fuels overall, but in particular in the transportation sector, we're going to suffer a tremendous cost in terms of public health in terms of the dollars we spend on public health, which in the book I document is already somewhere around $600 to $700 billion every single year in dealing with the health impacts from burning petroleum. And obviously global warming will continue to get worse, and the impacts from that and the devastation that that will cause. I wrote the book before the Stern report came out, which in the last couple of weeks has documented that the economic impact could be as severe as the Great Depression. So I think my postcard from the year 2025 was not that outlandish. We are already marching around the globe defending our supply of oil by invading other countries and killing people. That is only going to be exacerbated, and many of those countries are fighting back. We see people fighting back in Nigeria and Ecuador and other places where average citizens have not benefited from oil extraction in their countries. So it's a fairly bleak health picture and economic future. The alternative postcard is one that's much brighter. If we shake our oil addiction, if we move toward alternative fuels, as I talk about in the book, if we hold the various corporate conspirators responsible for their behavior and force them, as we did with tobacco, to invest a small amount of their kingly profits in alternative energy, which will actually help them stay afloat as companies long into the future, then we can have cleaner air, healthier citizens, and much better geopolitics, and hopefully solve the growing threat from climate change.
You've been alluding to this, but what are the best solutions to overcoming our addiction to oil?
Well, there's a couple. I mean, first of all, government has to act, and I advocate in the book a legal strategy, as you mentioned, that would hold the oil and auto companies accountable, just as we did tobacco companies. Our attorneys general in various states are already beginning to file cases. In California, about 6 weeks ago, our attorney general filed a case against the major automakers to hold them accountable for the cost of dealing with climate change. And if that makes its way through the courts, I suspect it'll set a precedent for holding them accountable for other costs like health care, much like we did with tobacco. So that's a good step. We're also, that's sort of the stick. The carrot is, of course, things like, again, in California, I'll use it as an example, that we've incentivized significantly the increase of solar panels. We've increased, we've provided incentives for biofuels like ethanol and biodiesel, and we're accelerating the experimentation with cellulosic ethanol, which is where you take wood cuttings and other higher cellulose material, let's say, for example, the stalk of the corn, not just the kernel of the corn, to make ethanol. And working with harvesting natural gas from landfills and other renewable sources to make a fleets of natural gas cars and fueling stations. And, of course, hydrogen. It's taking time for that technology to be perfected, but in California we have a hydrogen highway where we have already 30 fueling stations and several hundred vehicles, some in the hands of ordinary citizens already, and by 2008 the beginning of commercially available hydrogen vehicles will be seen in showrooms. So there's a lot that government can do, that we can force industry to do, but it's also up to us to take action immediately. And in the book, I talk about ways that no matter what kind of vehicle you drive, you can probably get 10 to 15% better fuel economy literally overnight with a few simple strategies like inflating your tires properly and driving the speed limit, not going 70 or 80 miles an hour when the freeway is wide open, because that extra 10 or 15 miles an hour consumes prodigious amounts of fuel, more than if you stayed at, say, 55 or 60. A number of other simple strategies. And so then as you buy another car, obviously trying to get a hybrid or one of the more fuel-efficient models in whatever version you need. And then hopefully as the other alternatives are available, more companies are getting back into the electric car manufacturing, and there's already natural gas cars and more biofuel cars, ethanol and so forth. People need to vote with their pocketbooks. And then there's another way of voting, which is to make sure that when you go into that ballot box and you literally vote, that that's one of the highest litmus tests that you put on every political candidate.
Let's go into some more detail about some of the efforts of the state of California to overcome our addiction to oil. Could you give us the history of zero emission vehicles in California and how that's played out?
Well, it was a simple notion by our state air board that if we had some kind of a small but growing percentage of zero-emission vehicles in the fleet, that it would then commercialize the technology, and over time it would displace the petroleum-powered vehicles. And obviously there wasn't any help from the auto or oil industry, and so the Air Board said, look, we have to do this because of the public health implications and the other costs of doing business on petroleum. And so in the early 1990s, they set a mandate. They said that by the year 2000, we should have a very small percentage, 2 or 3% of our cars should be zero emission. And they didn't say it had to be battery electric or hydrogen or anything else, but just zero emission. Let the best technology win. Well, the car companies immediately started fighting it. They filed suit. They lobbied with false information. They used the Automobile Alliance to put forward false science, saying, look, we can't make zero-emission vehicles because battery electric is the only way to do it, and there's no batteries that will get enough of a range for consumers to purchase them. And while they were saying this, they were buying up companies like Ovonix and others who had developed the battery technology and keeping them silent or keeping those batteries off the market, literally lying under oath to our Air Board about that. And they fought us in court. Unfortunately, they won some of the battles. Make a long story short, our state regulators blinked in the face of these challenges and reduced the mandates. First of all, delayed them significantly, and then significantly reduced them. So effectively gutting the zero-emission vehicle program. You know, as we look back on it now with 2020 hindsight, we know what happened. We know that both the oil and auto industries gamed the system. The oil companies, as I document in the book, even went to the major utilities in California and said, if you support electric cars, which many of the utilities were, because of course they would sell electricity to recharge the cars, we will take our business elsewhere. And our large refineries or some of your biggest customers will build our own power plants and get ourselves off the grid. You'll lose your biggest customers. And so they bullied even the state's utilities into not supporting the zero-emission vehicle mandate.
Could you say more about your evaluation of hydrogen as an alternative to gasoline?
Well, it really is the one technology that holds the hope of displacing the majority of our petroleum. Certainly, biofuels have great promise, but right now, most of the ethanol is being made from corn that's produced in the Midwest and takes a lot of energy input, especially from petroleum fossil fuels and petroleum fertilizers and things like that. And then, of course, you've got to put it on a train and send it with a fairly dirty diesel combustion to get it to, in our case, the West Coast, to turn it into something useful. So it has promise, but it's not without problem. And the best estimates that we can see for biofuels in the future are that they could displace 10 to 15% of our petroleum use. Now, that's not insignificant, and that's why we continue to support that technology, especially, as I mentioned before, cellulosic ethanol, but it's not going to solve the problem completely. Battery electric, same thing. Obviously, it would put if everyone overnight drove a battery electric car, it would strain the grid, and we're currently burning fossil fuels for a lot of our electricity on the grid, although a growing percentage is coming from renewables. So the one thing that holds the promise to displace 50, 60, 70, 80% of our petroleum use is hydrogen. And the technology is there. You can combust hydrogen even in today's internal combustion engines. It's not as efficient as using a fuel cell. But with hybrid technology, for example, if you burn hydrogen in your Prius, it's almost as efficient as a fuel cell. And of course, a fuel cell is the sort of newer technology that converts hydrogen into electricity, so essentially you're driving an electric car. And the only constraint to that at the moment is price. It costs about 10 times more for a hydrogen fuel cell stack, than an internal combustion engine for a comparably sized car. And, of course, that's really just a matter of mass production. The technology is there. I've been driving a hydrogen fuel cell car in Sacramento for the past year, provided by Daimler Chrysler as part of a demonstration project. And believe me, the technology is certainly ready for prime time.
Could you address the fact that hydrogen takes more energy to produce hydrogen than the unit returns in useful energy to the vehicle?
Well, there's no free lunch. You know, whether you're making a battery and putting energy into the creation of that battery, or whether you're producing a gallon of gasoline, or hydrogen. Everything takes a certain energy input to get useful energy out. Right now, gasoline on average is about 1.25 units of energy to produce for every one usable unit of energy to consume. Hydrogen is about 1.6 to 1, depending on how you make it. That equation is rapidly changing because as we have to go farther and farther for oil, whereas we have to drill deeper to get it, as we have to use more refining to take out impurities, as we literally get to the bottom of the petroleum fields, and they're full of more sulfur and other things, it takes more and more energy to convert every gallon of petroleum into gasoline. So the 1.6 to 1 for gasoline is actually increasing. And some are saying that the future of petroleum is in tar sands and tar shale, a lot of which is in Canada. Well, the early experiments with that show that you're going to be putting about 4 units of energy in for every 1 unit of energy out. So petroleum is getting, from an energy budget perspective, more and more unaffordable every day. Hydrogen, on the other hand, because you can make it from solar energy, electrolyzing, even wastewater, you can take a waste product, you can make it from dairy waste or agricultural waste just by biodigestion, and a number of other ways, you can make it for a positive energy conversion. In other words, if you take dairy waste as an example, you can put in as little as a half a unit of energy for every full unit of energy that you get out. So hydrogen is getting a better energy balance, whereas petroleum, as I mentioned, is getting increasingly a worse energy balance.
Could you also say a few words about the fact that hydrogen can be made more locally compared to getting petroleum from far away?
Well, that's it. You can make hydrogen from whatever you have locally. So if you have in the Pacific Northwest a lot of hydropower, you can use that clean electricity to electrolyze water, even wastewater, to make the hydrogen. And there's enough hydrogen in a gallon of water to run your car the same distance it now goes on a gallon of gasoline. So think gallon of water equals gallon of gasoline. And the sewage treatment plants in each city produce more than enough treated water to power your local transportation fleet. In fact, in Los Angeles, our sewage treatment plant every day dumps into the Pacific Ocean enough hydrogen in the form of wastewater to power the entire United States transportation fleet. So that shows you don't really need that much water. You do need electricity, and that can come from solar, or it can come from hydropower or other increasingly clean sources. Wind, a perfect example, because wind power is one of those things that doesn't always blow at the right time of day for ordinary electricity consumption. But if it blows at night, for example, you can use the electricity to break hydrogen out of water and then use that either to power your electrical grid when you need it or for transportation fuel. And, of course, biodigestion, as I mentioned, you can take green waste or agricultural waste or other types of waste and convert that into hydrogen if that's what you have locally.
You said a few words about this earlier, but how far has the state of California come so far in building a hydrogen infrastructure and helping to commercialize hydrogen?
Well, the challenge for us and for everyone else has always been the chicken or the egg. No one wants to mass produce vehicles if there is not a robust fueling network. And energy companies don't want to get into building fueling stations if there are not vehicles to use it. So we created the Hydrogen Highway Program in California about 3 years ago, and it laid out a blueprint working collaboratively with energy and auto companies and academics and government to say, let's make this a tide that lifts all boats on a predictable schedule. So we're building about 200 stations between now and 2010. The first 30 are up and operating, and that's given confidence to the automakers to start delivering more vehicles. We expect to have in the tens of thousands between now and 2010 or 2015, and at that point they will be commercialized and available in showrooms. Of course, early models will be a little more expensive, as you know, early adopters of anything are, but we're hoping, especially in a place like California, that we'll have enough of those early purchasers to then stimulate more mass production and bring the price down for everyone in that time frame of 2010 to 2015.
In your book, you discuss legal strategies or lawsuits as a way to bring about change in the oil and auto companies. Why do you think the legal system is one of the best ways to bring about change?
Well, it worked with tobacco, and as I mentioned before, there's so many similarities between oil and auto companies and their products and tobacco. But secondly, because, as I've documented in the book, there's this long history of a pattern and practice of lies and deceit and the oil and auto companies doing things like initially appearing to embrace the zero-emission vehicle mandate, but working behind the scenes to kill it, working behind the scenes to kill catalytic converters, despite on the face of it appearing to embrace them early on, things like that. So I think the courts are a way to force change, to leave no ambiguity about what public policy needs to be, and to hold these companies accountable for this kind of despicable behavior and the costs that they're burdening the rest of us with. Because in addition to lives per gallon, as I document in the book, all of the subsidies that we give to the oil and auto industry add up to another $6 or $7 a gallon. So every time you go to the gas station and you pump $2 or $3 a gallon gas, it's probably closer to $10 a gallon. We're just not paying it all at the pump.
What types of legal action do you suggest for making companies pay the true cost of what they are doing and changing their ways?
Well, I'm not a lawyer, but I did work with some lawyers on this and those who have worked on the tobacco cases, and I think the model is right there in the tobacco cases. And so you might start with something as simple as common nuisance. I mean, many people say to me, well, Terry, you know, cars and cigarettes are different because, you know, everyone uses cars, not everyone smoked, and cars are heavily regulated, which tobacco was not. And that's true, but if somebody opens a barbecue restaurant next to your home and the barbecue every night is pouring soot into your open window, they may be operating with a permit completely legally, but they don't have the right to create that nuisance that harms your use of enjoyment of your home. So you can go to court and sue them under common nuisance and say, look, you're operating legally, but you can't create this nuisance and destroy my property or my values and force them to, you know, clean up their barbecue. Well, the same thing is true here. And as I mentioned, the Attorney General in California has brought the first nuisance suit against the six major automakers and said that, you know, you may be operating legally, but your tailpipe emissions are causing a nuisance to the state of California, i.e., you're creating climate change. And we're spending millions of dollars to respond to that, not to mention the billions of likely impacts. And therefore, you should have to compensate the state or stop creating this nuisance.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Well, first of all, just awareness. I mean, I think people need to understand the true cost that they're paying, the fact that while you can walk away from secondhand tobacco smoke, you cannot walk away from secondhand tailpipe smoke in this country. 100% of the air we're breathing is contaminated with the byproducts of petroleum combustion. And it's harming us in so many ways, and it's got to end. And we've got to be part of it by voting our conscience on this, by voting our pocketbooks on this, and by demanding that our state and other government officials take action, as well as changing our own personal behavior.
Well, thanks so much for being here.
My pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
We have just been speaking with Terry Tamminen, former head of the California EPA and author of the book Lives Per Gallon, The True Cost of Our Oil Addiction, published in 2006 by Island Press. For more information, check on the web at www.livespergallon.org. Again, that's livespergallon.org. You can also check out Terry's personal site, terrytamminen.com, and Tamminen is T-A-M-M-I-N-E-N. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, selected sustainability segment interviews are now available as podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on Podcasting, and scroll down to Mind Over Matters Sustainability segment. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week.